Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to Just a Sip, everybody. I am so honored to have my guest on today. I watched every season of the original America's Next Top Model, and I didn't even know that people paid you to be this fabulous. Please welcome judge, icon, legend of reality TV, Jay Manuel. Either a bitch does not age, or she can do a good beat, or both. You have not changed a lick, I swear to God, since the early 2000s. What the hell are you doing to that face?
Do you know, everybody always says that. And the thing is, you know, if you look at my parents, I mean, just everyone in my family, everyone looks young. But I mean, I take care of myself. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I don't know. I don't do anything crazy.
Wait, hold on. You said your parents. I've always wanted to know this. What is your background? Because I remember seeing you on reality TV. I remember seeing you on America's
Next Top Model. No one knew what I was.
No one knew what you were. And it was funny because I was like, I think he reminds me of me because he's gay, but he might be black, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, is he Asian? Is he what?
Let's set the record straight. So I grew up in Toronto. I was born in the States, but I grew up in Toronto, which is such a great, like, multicultural, like, you know, just diverse culture to grow up in. And so for me, I grew up identifying as black because I'm not white. I'm biracial. My father was black. My mother is white. And I say, you know, because one of the stories that I kind of give Pablo Michaels, who's my protagonist in my book, because he's not me, but there's a lot of me in him,
yeah.
Is my own personal adoption story, because a lot of people don't know that I'm adopted. And so I am biracial, but my last name is pronounced Manuel, but people say Manuel, then they think I'm Spanish, but Manuel is a South African last name. My parents are from South Africa, so I always grew up identifying, you know, with this kind of South African background and knowing I'm biracial, but I just grew up always saying, if someone asked me, you know, what I was, I'm like, well, I'm black. Now, to some black girls, they're like, oh, well, you're not black enough. Yeah, you know, you're not black enough. Spanish people realize I wasn't Spanish. And then I'm certainly not white. So I always felt like I was caught in the middle once I'd moved to the States, because I came to the States when I was 19 and I went to NYU. That's where I felt awkward. I didn't feel weird growing up in Canada.
So they don't care.
They don't care. But you know what's weird? I talked to Halle Berry about this once a long time ago, and I posted a photo somewhat recently of Halle and I together as a throwback Thursday, because I admire her so much and she's such a beautiful spirit. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you look at us side by side, a lot of people go, oh, you two look like siblings because we're both biracial. Now it's interesting that the black community accept her as black. She's the first black woman to win an Oscar. She's, you know, she's amazing. She's brilliant. But when you look at us side by side, we have the same skin tone. But for some reason, people don't look at me as black, which is so, it's been something that I just was been frustrating. But at the same time, I let people have their own opinions. It's not about what they think.
You know why? Let me tell you why. It's because I obviously, my skin tone has not changed. I've been this dark my whole life, but I went to school with a lot of private school white kids. And when I went back to the hood, you know, I wasn't black enough for the black kids. And when I went back to private school, I wasn't white enough for the white kids. But I think if you had done a show that was majority Black people or on a Black network, I think it would have been different. You know, Halle Berry did Jungle Fever, so we gave her her Black card at that point. But you did America's Next Top Model, and that was the thing.
But you got to remember, America's Next Top Model, season one and two was on UPN. Everybody forgets that before the CW. Yes. And just a little bit of tea, if you want some tea. Tyra pitched that show everywhere. And they said, no. UPN took it. And because she'd not produced something before, they assigned a showrunner, which was Ken Mock, who became one of the co-EPs on the show. So yes, you know, when you look at that show, we were on UPN. Tyra was the host, you know, Miss J, runway coach. You've got me, I was the creative director. We represented all different shades across the spectrum. And still yet people thought I was Spanish, but then the Spanish kids go, oh, he's not Spanish, he's not Latin, he's not. It was just, but I just decided I was just being myself. You know, I wasn't trying to be an advocate for anyone. I was just trying to do the best work that I could is really all I was trying to do at that point.
I love that UPN was like, we're going to give you Ken Mock. And Tyra was like, yeah, but that, I'm going to do what I have to do. And it turned out, honestly, to be one of the greatest, most groundbreaking shows that we have ever seen on television history. And, you know, what you said was we're just trying to be you. But to a young Black gay boy in the South, I was like, oh, this man got out and he's got silver hair. I could do it too. You know,
yes.
You probably didn't realize that at home, because social media wasn't around back then.
There was no social media. No.
Yeah. And I was like, damn, this guy is awesome. Like, I can see myself in him. But it's funny because for as many years as I watched you on that show and on Live from the Red Carpet, I just never knew how you got into America's Next Top Model or even the fashion game. So what was that rise from start to finish to getting on America's Next Top Model? Because I didn't even know what a creative director was at that point in my life.
It is a long story before, but I'll give you the Cliff Notes version and any gaps you need, you just ask the question. Ultimately, I was already working in the industry as a makeup artist. I mean, a lot of people don't know, I even moved to New York to come to be an opera singer. This is actually part of the story as to how I even got into makeup, which is crazy. But I was studying privately and going to NYU. And my first voice teacher, because I sang in the Mendelssohn Choir, traveled all over the world as a young teenager.
Yeah.
She got cast in Martin Scorsese's Age of Innocence as the opera singer. She's the first person you see in the film. That was my voice teacher since I was 13 years old, private voice teacher. And so had decided at that point, and this was before she got cast in the film, she brought me to New York to sing for her voice teacher. That's how I came to New York. I said, well, I have to be here. Nonetheless, I decided to change. I had applied to University of Toronto, et cetera. I've been accepted and I wanted to go to NYU. And since I was born in the States, it was easy for me to move here. I decided last minute to go to NYU. She got cast in the film. Then they needed to do photos of her for just like press and stuff like that out of character. And it was always a hobby of mine playing with makeup and styling and this and that. And she was terrible at it. So she said, can you come get me ready? So I said, sure. The photographer that shot her ended, he was like a huge deal to shooting, Sony classics, Deutsche Grammophon, all these CD covers. So he saw my work and says, do you realize you're really talented at this? And I was like, so naive and silly. I was like, no, I'm an opera singer. I'm trying to be serious, blah, blah, blah. Cut to 2 months later, I was like at school, broke, thinking I could use a job. So I called him up and said, I don't know if you remember me, because he gave me his card. Basically, I had done that photo shoot with her. That's how he saw my work. So I went back and he said, well, I'll hire you for a job. So the first job I did was with a famous opera singer that no one will know. But then when that shoot ended, he said, oh, next week we're doing a CD cover for the Metropolitan Opera. I'd love to have you do it.
Hold. First of all, for everybody in the audience, if y'all don't know, God is fair and God loves gay people, because every gay man has a trait, an inner trait. You're either a hair and makeup queen, you're a home and garden queen, you are a lobbyist queen. Like everybody, I don't know what it is, you get introduced to this life. I didn't realize that I knew events until I assisted someone because I needed the money. And then all of a sudden, that one little thing wakes up in you. It's like Avatar, where they explain to you where you came from, what the tree means.
Yes.
And every person has that one thing, because God is fair and God loves gays. So
you're an opera singer and you do the CD cover.
So I said, sure, I'll do it. Then he drops the bomb. We're shooting Luciano Pavarotti for the cover. That's my first celebrity I ever worked with. Can you believe that? And I had to put him in character. And I'm not a hairdresser. The Metropolitan Opera messaged me over his custom lace wig. I didn't know what to do with it. I took it to a hairdresser to learn about blocking wigs, and they set the wig. I showed up at the shoot, and then I kind of put him into character. They sent character references over. That was really my break into hair makeup. Then an agent saw my work. I started working with all these celebrities, magazines. Cut to my first time working with Tyra. Was I was booked as a backup because her makeup artist missed a flight.
Wow.
Yes. And this was years before Top Model. And we hit it off. She was presenting at the GQ Man of the Year Awards. And I went to the hotel room. By the way, did her makeup for free as a test. She's like, well, I'm going to test him out. So I did her makeup. So I always say to these millennials now, like, do the free job.
Do the free job.
And literally from there, like a week later, I was shooting Victoria's Secret with her in the Caribbean, and like the rest was history, basically.
Everybody rewind this right now, okay? Rewind that story, because this is what I talk about when I say the universe works in mysterious ways. The universe puts you in opera,
yes,
so that you would know and you would understand the importance of beating that face for Luciano Pavarotti. And Pavarotti, if you don't know who Pavarotti is, I suggest
Google.
You watch Showtime and you watch and you watch that. Yes. Have you seen that documentary?
First of all, have I seen, of course, his recent documentary that came out, like, was it the year before last? Oh yeah, he was an idol of mine and we had the same musical coach. So yes.
And even if you don't like opera music, this man is like the Keith Richards of opera. Beautiful.
Yes.
You've heard his music before. You've heard it in movies. You've seen it on, you know, billboards. You've seen him. But this is crazy that the universe led you to Tyra Banks and working with Victoria's Secret.
And I'd worked with other huge celebrities at that time and big supermodels, and worked by that point, I had worked for Vogue and Harper's Bazaar and stuff like that. And I used to shoot the Vogue portraits. I was hired to do that every month before I met Tyra. So Tyra was real. It was literally, well, let's see his work. Okay,
yeah.
I'll try him out. But still, I mean, I could have easily been bougie and said, oh, well, I'm already in the mix.
Yeah.
I don't need to work for free.
Yeah.
But, you know, I grew up very kind of humble, and I always admired her. And I still, to this day, I respect every like door she has stomped down, what she represents to so many little brown and black little boys and girls. And she's created so much opportunity. And so right there, you know, I was like, of course I want to work with her. And then we became close. And then I remember the first night that she literally called me. It was 6 a.m, 3 a.m. LA time.
Because geniuses work early.
Yeah, and
geniuses work early.
Yeah, yeah. And she wanted to talk about, I got this idea about this show. And so a little bit of that in that moment inspired by is right there in chapter 3 of my book. It's called The Show Is Born. So I kind of use that moment and that phone call a little bit for my story, which is fiction.
First of all, before we go any further, do you do the audiobook?
Well, we just finished that deal. And I didn't know this, but most authors who do, you know, so for in the nonfiction world, they have the authors read, but fiction, they always hire actors. But I am a performer. And so I had to audition for my own audiobook.
Hell yeah.
And they loved it. And of course, so I'm like, I have to read this book. So I auditioned for my own book. You should see me in my closet.
Because, you know, I love an audiobook. I love an audiobook.
Yes.
But it's so crazy because there are a few things about the show that I, even as a young kid, I always knew that this must be how the world of modeling and fashion and beauty is. It's cutthroat. It's not easy. Sometimes it's blunt. Sometimes they want you to get that makeover. If you had to say from your experience, how close really was A&TM to the actual industry?
Well, in terms of it being critical and difficult and models being asked to do bizarre things, I'd say it's pretty much, you know, neck and neck. That this industry, I'm talking about the fashion industry right now, which everyone thinks is so inclusive and so great already, really isn't. It's very cutthroat. And yes, in the fashion industry, we've seen in the last 10 years, more Black models, et cetera, and campaigns. But I look at it as racialized capitalism because we got to look at who's actually behind the scenes,
yes,
what they're doing, and who they're hiring. And bravo to Anna Wintour to finally stepping up and saying, we've not done enough at American Vogue. And, you know, colleagues of mine from the past, like Edward Unenfall, who is incredible. I've worked with him on major campaigns back in the day. You know, what he's done at British Vogue is incredible, not only on the pages of British Vogue, but behind the scenes. Look at that staff. You see every kind of nationality represented behind the scenes. Yes. And that's the type of work we need to see happening in the fashion industry right now.
I totally and 100% agree. And it's really weird because there's this cancel culture that's coming up, you know, in this moment where people aren't giving people enough time and enough space to make the changes that they need to make. And you're right. Hearing companies say, hey, guys, I obviously see that we have not done enough and we are willing to change. Give us time. I just feel like people don't give people the time, you know, that they need and they deserve to make those moments. Because I do agree with you. It's about the people who are setting the tone, about the people who are hiring in the back, who are casting, who are actually producing, who are telling these stories. And
yes,
I didn't see those things happen. I used to work for BCBG in Max's Rita. You know, I didn't see those things. You know, I was the only Black guy on the styling team. Everybody else was Lily White. There was maybe one or two Asians running around. Like my girlfriend, you know, Tiffany Tang worked there, who was beautiful and gorgeous and so creative. But that was about it. You know, we didn't really see it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, even with my novel, I wanted, yes, it's this really fun, laugh out loud, satirical piece, but I wanted there to be a gravitas to the piece that really looked at not only because, of course, the world of Model Muse, which is inspired by America's Next Top Model, has a foot in the entertainment world and a foot in the fashion world, and they kind of collide behind the scenes. And ultimately, you know, these are human stories that I'm telling, and hopefully they shift the paradigm about how we think about power, authority, and relationships. But I really wanted to hit some really core themes kind of sitting kind of beneath this. It's as a subtext, like looking at how the entertainment industry deals with you know, the abuse of power and what's the cost of fame, and also how both the fashion and entertainment industry deal with intersectionality and Black woman's identity, because all of that factors into the psychology around Keisha Cash, who is the supermodel host of Model Muse in my book. And I really sat down and I spoke with two psychologists, and with all my characters, I wanted there to be a 360 build so that you understand what's motivating people's actions, so that, you know, this story is told in a more whole sense while it's still laugh out loud, funny and cringy, and you talk to the pages at times. But yeah, but there's still this kind of gravitas and this important theme underneath.
Normally, you know, people write the book about, you know, related to, because obviously you have been in this game for a long time and you have been in the front lines and behind the scenes. So, you know where the bodies are buried. So normally you write that book once you're like, you know what? I'm Quincy Jones. F this. I'm 75. I'm out of here. I'm not going to be doing it anymore, you know, because out of fear of retaliation. When you were writing this book, did you ever get nervous that somebody, because, you know, we've worked with people who have big egos, and sometimes the ego can get in the way and people can be like, oh, that's about me. No, that's about me. I can't believe you put this. When really, it was not really about that person. It was just the essence of that person. Are you ever afraid that someone, you know, from the industry is going to feel that way and, you know, feel some type of way and run up on you?
That's a great question. I have, and again, not only the characters within the show of Model Muse, because it's inspired by Top Model, I've used all my experiences in the entertainment industry to tell these very important stories and highlight these themes so that we can continue to have discussions. I'd say in the very beginning, when I outlined the story, I was worried about two things. One, how would people react to me kind of telling these several stories, because there are a lot of subplots in the book. But secondly, you know, the literary world itself, I broke convention. Like, I'm not spoiling anything, but towards the last third of the book, you know, I blur the lines, I break the fourth wall a little with this metafictional kind of mechanism, which, you know, my agent said is very Black Mirror.
I'm here and for it.
So it was important for me to kind of tell the story authentically. And I had to kind of get over that hurdle and realize what the intent was behind the writing. And as long as the intention is pure and honorable, I figured, okay, I'm going to just go forward with it. And hopefully, you know, people will accept it and embrace it and see it for what it is. And the discussion that I'm trying to have, because ultimately the book is a journey of self, and it's this journey of awakening and realizing, and this is something we can all relate to. We all have to, we're constantly looking for external validation, but the validation that's the most important is our own. And getting to that place, that's Pablo's journey in the book. And I mean, there's a lot that happens in the book, but that's really where he goes.
So this is not like the ALT book where this bitch is trying to burn every bridge ever built in New York. Because I'm just telling you right now, I was like, you know, maybe I might get this book and maybe it might be, you know, might be good. And then the excerpts started coming out and you hear about all these big things. This is not that book, I'm guessing.
Andre's book is a memoir. My book is a novel. So there's a huge difference there. My book is a work of fiction. One of the people that I've greatly admired, and I love to read, it's kind of weird even bringing his name up in a sentence, but I've read every one of Dan Brown's books. And what I love about his writing, for two things. One, very fast paced. And my book is extremely fast paced, and it mirrors the insanity and the relentless nature of working behind the scenes on a show like Model Muse. So that's one. But two, Dan Brown is brilliant at taking fact and very real organizations and events and places, and he weaves fiction around it, his tale. And so I did the same thing. So for Top Model fans, there are Easter eggs all throughout my book. And you're going to go, oh, I know that moment. But now you're seeing it from a different side. And I think most people will, while they're reading the book, they're going to say, is that real or is that real? And they're going to try to discern what's fact from fiction. And that's part of the allure of the book.
But how do you, and I ask this in the most serious way possible.
Sure.
How do you decipher... Not decipher, because I feel like your life was fiction at this point. I mean, you played with gowns and hair and makeup and like larger than life personalities. How did you honestly, you know, keep those things separated? Because I feel like, I don't know, I feel like you lived in an imaginary world for so many years. Like, don't you?
Well, I'm a product of my upbringing and my amazing parents. And I was just kind of raised to keep my feet on the ground. And one of the things I tried to advise young models of is that fame isn't a real thing, and you have to keep the brand of who you are and who you are completely separate for two reasons. One, there'll be a place when everybody loves you, but they're loving the brand of who they think you are, and that's not you, and it can overinflate your sense of self, and inevitably they will tear that brand down at some point, always. And if you keep yourself separate from your brand, then it keeps your kind of core identity intact. And my book is an identity piece. And I'm trying to kind of get that message through the whole kind of this crazy story. So, you know, it's funny that you say you felt like I worked in this fantasy world, and I felt the opposite. It was a very serious, very cutthroat world. And I didn't think it was a fantasy land at all.
It's because you were serving face and hair the whole time. You were serving face and hair. And I know when I'm living in a hard world and my job is hard, I don't look like this. I ain't serving face and hair. I'm serving
Justin, tears. I have seen you go at the same award shows that I used to be on the red carpet for with E. And I know exactly, you were sitting there snatched, glowing, and on point. Mm. You know how to pull it together. Don't even try and think up front right now. I'm sorry. Not buying it.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You know, it's so crazy because you talk about how people will always attack that brand. And it's funny because, you know, everybody was living for Tyra. Everybody was living for America's Next Top Model. Everybody wanted to be on America's Next Top Model. I was pissed when they didn't do men until I was in college, or well after college. And I was too big by then. I had hit the freshman 15. There was no way I was going to compete on America's Next Top Model. But, you know, it's crazy that years later, this whole thing happened with the Gap and Tyra was too hard and this was happening. At that time, did you think it was too far?
Well, certain things, absolutely. You know, the culture behind the scenes of the show, which is something that I do very, I think, accurately portray, you know, in my novel, was the, it started off, you know, bubblegum and roses and everyone was happy and excited and we thought we'd maybe only get two seasons and that was it. And then the culture behind the scenes really shifted with producers and talent, and you'll get a really good sense of it when in the book. But there was a one moment, and to back that up a little bit, right now we know Top Model had this huge resurgence during the pandemic because people wanted nostalgia. Then you had this new audience tuning in, looking at it through a very different lens. So I do feel Tyra was kind of thrown under the bus unfairly so, but I don't defend everything, because at the time, even in cycle four, when we were doing this Got Milk ad, last minute there was this creative that was thrown at me, because by then everyone wanted their hand in the creative because I was hiring all the creative talent and doing the shoots. Then I got these layers and these notes. Oh, I think we're gonna not only have the girls hold babies, we're gonna swap races. And I thought, okay, I was uncomfortable with it. My parents grew up under apartheid. I'm biracial. I have my own kind of identity issues around, you know, what that means. And so now we're going to swap races. And at that time, the culture was shifting rapidly behind the scenes. And I didn't even feel I could go to my executive producers. So I went to the co-EP at the time, who was wonderful. And I just said, I can't do this shoot. I am going to take all the heat for this shoot. I am not like a Tyra at this point in my career. I'm like, there's no way I will survive this. I can't do this.
Because your name is on the
shoot. I'm at the shoot. So she said, and I'm the creative director. That's my chyron as well. And I produced behind the scenes. I was told I had to do that shoot and show up. And they said, don't worry, we'll cover you in the edit. And we'll make sure you're not kind of dragged for it. And I was so uncomfortable. Like, if you actually watch that introduction for that episode and go back and watch it, it's not me. Like, I'm literally kind of, I'm carefully choosing my words. I look really uncomfortable. It's edited carefully, but I did not want to do that shoot at all.
But this is where, okay, so this is a good question because I want to know this. At what point did you say, it, I'm just going to do it and get this cash? And why? Because obviously you were uncomfortable. Obviously you didn't want to do it. You knew, your gut told you not to do it. Why still go along with it?
Well, I had a contract. I had a network contract with several cycles. And, you know, there was a behind the scenes, and it's really sad to say, there was like a fear culture developed.
Yeah.
Something I've never experienced anywhere else. I've worked for several different shows. I've hosted other shows. I worked at E! For how many years? That culture did not exist for me, you know, even in the E! Environment behind the scenes. But there was, on Top Model, there was a bit of this fear culture. So I kind of had to go along with it. But what people don't know, and I only very recently said this, I mean, as in like 3 days ago, because someone said to me, well, you stayed there to cycle 18. Why were you there till cycle 18? And I said, well, what people don't know is when my contracts were up after cycle 8, I was free and clear to do whatever I wanted to do. And they wanted to renegotiate 4 more cycles. And I reached out to Tyra first because she always asked me to speak with her first. We never wanted to go through our people, our agents, our lawyers. And I said, unfortunately, I can't come back to the show. I feel like and very genuinely, I said, I feel like I've given all I can to the show, and I'm going to work on other things. Tyra's a businesswoman. I thought for sure she'd understand it. I thought I was being really lovely and respectful.
Yeah.
She absolutely, she just had 2 words for me. I'm disappointed. And that was it. That was the end of the discussion. And they were between cycles. They had 3 months. And so they screen tested other very well-known fashion people for my role. And I won't say who they were, but it's not hard to figure out who some of them were. And then literally 2 weeks out of production, so we're going months down, and I've not told this story in this detail, so you're getting the scoop on this one.
Yes.
Literally, I hadn't taken a vacation in 3 years. So I was on a vacation, and they were 2 weeks from their production. And my attorney at that time called me and said, oh, they've come back and asked, could you do just one cycle? Just one cycle as a one-off until they find the right person. And I said, unfortunately, I took another commitment, as you know. I agreed to do this one-off cycle, which I was just going to be talent, but I wasn't producing the shoots. This was cycle nine when we went to China and everything. I did not produce. It looked like I was producing like the same role. The audience didn't notice the difference. But they told me, you'll show up. Everyone's happy you're back. So when I flew in, saw the producers. We did the casting on a cruise ship. It was a horrible experience. But anyway, I show up and they said everyone was acting normal with me and they said it'd be fine. And I knew Tyra was upset. We'd never not talked for a period of time because we used to talk every day.
Yeah. You know,
then I show up. Well, catch this, Justin. She walks in. I flew in. So the first time I see her is walking onto set, you know, the panel we do in casting.
Yeah.
And I just said, hey, I'm so glad you're here early because I just want to walk right by, like, did not talk to me. And I was like, wait, maybe she just didn't hear. I thought there's no way she ignored me. I thought because she was talking to someone, she just didn't hear me. So I sit down at the judging table, which is small. It's me, her, Miss J. And I start to talk to her. And she's like, oh, you know, Miss J. Oh, Ken Mock, blah, blah, blah. She's talking to people, but just not talking to me.
Wow.
And I instantly, my heart went in my throat. It's a very painful experience. And I've never talked about it before. And I couldn't talk about it contractually before. And then as soon as the cameras rolled, it was all love and light and looking at me and touching me. Tape change, back turned. And we went the entire cycle until the second last episode, with which when she called me into her, I got a message to come see her in her hotel room. And to be fair, she apologized and said, I wasn't being professional. I am an executive producer. You are talent here. I should have been more professional. And she apologized. But things weren't great. And yes, after that, they said they would like me to come back. And I did agree to sign on for a few more cycles. But I couldn't talk about all of this contractually, you know, and it was just, it never really recovered. And it wasn't fun the second half of my term there.
You know, what's really interesting is, and I'm sorry that you went through that because I know what it feels like. And it feels terrible to work with someone who does not like you, who has power over you. I've done that in past jobs before, and it is not fun. And I think whenever you get that threat as a gay, biracial minority,
you
in
feel like
Hollywood,
the dirt on the gum on the bottom of the shoe. Like, I mean, literally, you feel like the dirt on the gum on the bottom of the shoe. And it is interesting that you bring in, you know, this identity around being gay, about being a minority, because you literally are looked at as the last. And I went to her with such respect, and I've always worked. I gave 150% of myself all the time. And she has left jobs and moved on. Like, she left Victoria's Secret. She's done other things. And I went to her very honestly saying I couldn't. And I was free and clear to move on. And yet there was this warped power dynamic and then this emotional manipulation that was very difficult. I mean, things did get better for a time, but it was so strained after that.
But you can't go back. You can't recover after something like that. And it actually goes back to, and I'm, you know, not condemning her by any means, but it's going back to what you said about your identity getting stuck in the brand and you not being able to compartmentalize or to separate the two. She took it as a personal thing that you didn't want to come back, when in all honesty, you just really felt like you had given enough.
I'd moved on. You know, I was working with E! A lot, doing all the red carpets, you know, co-hosting with Ryan and Juliana and doing all these things at the time and working on other shows. It was really... It was time for me to kind of take that next step. And I was kind of, it was a very difficult kind of jolt backwards. And that cycle nine, I can't watch clips from it because I remember, I literally go back to that moment, like almost like a form of PTSD, literally. It was horrible.
It'll stay with you. And I say this because, everybody out there listening, you guys think Hollywood and LA is so big and like the fashion industry is so massive that you can jump around and, you know, once you get blackballed, you're going to have a moment. Like, you're going to have a tough time getting back on that horse because every producer knows every producer, every studio knows every studio. And back then, you know, if somebody got wind that you were done or you left somebody high and dry in one side of the narrative, it was a pretty, it was a pretty big deal. And being a gay person and not knowing when you're going to be able to get that representation back on TV, like you almost probably felt like you had to do it for the better, the bigger cost.
Yeah, I mean, I did agree to go back after that Cycle 9. We did try to mend our relationship because even before Top Model, I mean, when she was in New York, she would be sleeping at my house. You know, it was, we had that kind of relationship. So that never, it never got back to that point. We did get, you know, things did get better. We did have good times. There were very magical, fun moments on that show. And I don't regret anything. Being a part of a global phenomenon is a huge opportunity, something I'll never forget. But there were also other lessons that were a little difficult. And I'm sure she has her reasons around why she reacted that way. And again, that's why I took the opportunity in this novel to kind of look at those pressures that someone like her, you know, like in my case, it's Keisha Cash, and what she had to deal with in terms of an industry that's run predominantly by white men and a beauty industry that supports the white aesthetic. What does that do psychologically to a black model in the industry? And so I really, you know, wanted to show this 360 portrait of Keisha in my book to hopefully shed light and also learn. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about myself writing this book because I wrote it myself, no ghostwriter. And I had a great writing mentor, but that isolation, especially when you work in a world of collaboration, you learn just so much about yourself. And it's the most fulfilling thing I've ever done, really.
100%. And it's so crazy that you can look at it from that outside perspective, because not everybody gets to write that book and really gets to examine, you know, the hardship and the, you know, kind of sort of the moments that, you know, define your life. But it's just crazy because I always tell people, I'm like, everyone's like, I can't believe One Direction broke up, you know, they were just doing so well. They're making so much money. I'm like, if you're unhappy in your situation, it doesn't matter how much money you're making or how much fame you have. You're unhappy. And it's crazy because to us, you were the dude and you had the job. And there was only one America's Next Top Model. And you pulled the shit off because we thought you were killing it and you were happy to be there. And you were, but that's part of being professional because, you know, as a black gay man, if I have a bad day,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like as a gay man, that sticks with you for a very long time if you have a sassy day. But if your other counterparts who are not in your lane or not in your box have a bad day, that's just Blair.
And that's what we had to examine. That's what I had to examine in the book, are these common themes and tropes that get assigned to, you know, different identities. And that's what I'm highlighting in my book and looking at. And again, I'm looking at the fashion and entertainment world colliding together. It creates like this pyramid of chaos and kind of these power dynamics that are completely warped, and understanding what everyone is going through on all different sides of that pyramid. And so yes, my book, it sounds very serious. I mean, it is, it's meant to entertain. It is a screaming, laugh out loud time, but there is this whole thing going on underneath.
Ooh, I cannot even wait. And it's even so crazier because, you know, when I look back at, God, I mean, Victoria's Secret, Vogue, and ANTM, like, you come, I can't believe that you are not in a Smithsonian somewhere, okay?
Because, oh my God, I've never thought about it that way, but
you're talking about three different brands that cemented and who that started institutions. I don't know a girl who did not want to be a Victoria's Secret angel at one point. You know, bitch, I wanted to be a Victoria's Secret angel. How do you do it? Like, how do you do it? But it's crazy, even looking back at those moments, you know, Tyra had to be extra because the black girl, like, she was going there. She was trying to show them who she was. She was trying to have those moments because it was all Brazilians at that point. It was all Brazilians and Dodson. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, I know exactly.
Secret.
Oh, Victoria's Secret. Oh, you know, it's such an interesting environment. I think people think it's like super, 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 super sexy and crazy. It's not at all. It's like a little family. It's a little fun shoot. Like even Giselle, as stunning as she is, when she steps off set, she takes a towel around her waist and walks away after she's been like posing her ass off. You know, everybody, it's very, you know, it's not what people think. And I've got a really fun story because I remember being in the hair makeup area, and this was right after we started America's Next Top Model, and you know, Tyra was still shooting Victoria's Secret. We were on cycle 2 of Top Model, and it was a big ad, and I was still doing her makeup at the time. And Heidi was in the chair next to her, and she's like, you know what? She was having her hair blown out. She goes, you know what would be amazing? What if you did the same show, but with designers? Catch this. Tyra went, that'll never work. Designers aren't as interesting. And Heidi... And she just went off and was like, okay.
No.
Mm-hmm. Desiree Gruber and Heidi said, oh, we got a show for you and it's gonna be called Project One Way. Boom, born. Ooh. I was there at the moment when Heidi said it to Tyra.
Damn.
And Tyra was like, it will never work. Boop, that could have been an easy pop off a Top Model, but oh well.
I used to work for Hervé Légère and Max Hasria. And there have been times at fashion shows where I go to get a girl ready. And I'm like, I don't think this bitch is going to make it to the shoot. And it's always a celebrity. You're like, I'm always like, hey, girl. Somebody went out hard last night. I don't think this is going to happen. Y'all might have to give her a front row seat to somebody else. And if you have a size
those moments do happen. And those models do go down. Like, I will give you a bit of a fact fiction blur. In my book, the kind of the highest paid supermodel who sits on the panel, her name is Sasha Berenson, and she goes out cold in an early scene in the book, and they have to shoot around her at the judging panel, and that may have actually happened with a Ms. Dickinson cycle 1, I believe, after it was like a late night judging and almost a big hefty helping of wine at a table.
Wait, by the way, why does that not
surprise you? You know, I'm going to get myself in trouble, Justin, because you see, I feel like I'm just kicking with you. Like we just hanging out on FaceTime, but really everyone's watching our conversation. I'm going to get in trouble, but it's true.
That's what we like.
We shot on a 4-shot. They went from a 5-shot. They literally said, just roll on a 4-shot with a head down on the table. I was right there. I'm not lying.
Mm-mm. Oh my God. You know, it's so funny that like, I think I know every single thing about you, but like, I wonder, cause I struggle with this right now and I'm trying to figure it all out. And that's finding love, you know, TV and having this kind of notoriety. When you're known as a personality, people think that that's the one facet that you are. That's what I struggle with.
Oh my gosh.
Sure. Was that the issue when you were on ANTM? And is that still now it has to break out of that?
For me, I do weave a little bit of this into Pablo's backstory. And it's in a very powerful scene because, and again, one of the things we have not talked about is, you know, again, Pablo Michaels is not J. Manuel. However, I did give him, you know, my whole kind of my very vulnerable personal adoption story because people don't know that about me. But, you know, it is very, very difficult when you do become very recognizable. And I'm sure you experienced this. As soon as people see you, whether it's romantically, friendship or whatever, you start to question intentions because people see the brand of you or who you're connected to or what you do. And they also think they know you because they know you through a lens. And it's not you. And I've felt for the longest time, like I'm in this lifestyle space, you know, even breaking out as a writer, people don't know that I did writing when I was at NYU, but being in this box and when you meet anyone, they just assume they know exactly who you are, what you like. Like I do love fashion. I love creating, you know, imagery, but if you look at a lot of my dear close friends, like they're not like into fashion. And I really don't care what you're wearing because I care about the human and the spirit inside of that package. So for me, it's been difficult. I think the best kind of relationships that I have are those often with people who didn't know me, like didn't recognize me from a show. It's kind of hard. Or it's I've art. Known them for so long that they've known me since before. But like the other day, you know, I met someone and we were talking. Everyone else was like, but that's Jay, but that's Jay. But they're like, who? What? And this is someone who's not into pop culture, or whatever. And I loved it. It was like a breath of fresh air because that person got to know me, my life, who I am, not all I've done, which like is yes, it's part of me, but it's not my identity.
For sure. You know, you can't run away from it. I can, you know.
I wear a baseball cap to hide my hair. Trust me.
Oh, I come with an alias. My name is Winston. I work at Goldman Sachs. I'm in finance, dumb financial. Like, you don't want to hear nothing about my job. And it's always, I'm telling you, I've gotten away with this a few times. I go with the alias. I normally say, honestly, I say, you know, I produce news. I work in news. Like,
okay, so that's not too much of a stretch. Okay, you're making it work. Yeah, yeah.
It's not too much of a stretch. You know, entertainment news, you know, I do blah, blah, blah. Second date. I'm like, yeah, you know, I produce talk show. Like, you know, it's just fun, entertainment, blah, blah, blah. And always right around the second or third date. Because the third date is when I say, you know, I got to be honest. I wasn't fully transparent about my job. I always run into, it's always a random woman who's like, oh, my God.
Like, oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm like,
just busting your cover, right? Just
busting my cover. I take the photo, and the guy's always like, what was that? I was like, she thought it was Idris Elba. It happens from time to time when I'm wearing a baseball cap. You know, like, it's not that big of a deal. They just think I'm Idris Elba or whatever. And it's crazy because, like, I don't know why I don't feel the need to be honest and proud about what I do, or like, I don't know. It's this weird thing.
I think you probably are proud of it. It's just the difference is it really kind of puts everything in a different spotlight. And you want people to understand and get to know you, like Justin, not the brand of who you are. And I get it. And, you know, sometimes I've actually played, I mean, I can't really get away with an alias, but since I've grown the beard like recently, you know, I wear a hat, people don't quite catch it's me. And then, but then people listen to my voice and they're like, you know, you kind of sound like, you know, do you know Jay Manuel, that top model, blah, 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 blah. And I'll say, wow. And they're like, but you're too tall. They'll always say, but you're too tall, because everyone thinks I'm short, because everyone thinks I'm 5'6". I'm 6'1". So everyone thinks I'm 5'7", 5'8", because Nigel is 6'4". Miss Jay is 6'4". Tyra's shorter than me at 5'10", but she's in heels. So everyone assumes I'm short. So I get away with it. And I went, yeah, I get that a lot. And so I'll play that they think I'm them, and then I hear what they think about me, because then they'll talk about, oh, yeah, well, blah, 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 blah. But then it only goes but so far before they're like, wait a minute.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. This is crazy. You know, you spoke about your adoption, which I think is so amazing. Have you found your birth parents?
I've never had the desire to. My parents, you know, and it's one of those things, you know, people, now that I've just started talking about it, and it is in the book, and my kind of my feelings around it, and it plays part of the main story towards the end and a reveal. But so I don't want to say too much, but I...
But let me tell you why I ask. Let me tell you why I ask before, because I don't want you to think I'm just being nosy.
No, it's not nosy.
Which, I'm just being nosy. But okay. I'm also thinking about adopting, you know, soon. And starting that process and that thought process of, you know, reading about it and coming to a decision of whether this is the road I want to go to. Mm-hmm. And I have a hiccup that I often think that my child would A, want to know, and B, I have this weird fear that I'm going to do the wrong thing. And
Can I set your mind at ease? I know exactly what to say. And I think my parents are... We're just incredible. First of all, you know, because my mother couldn't have children. She had a hysterectomy early on. So both my sister and I are adopted. And we were never told we were adopted. We always knew, because it was always made a special moment. Like, this is the day you came home. Oh, wow. You know, it was kind of like a thing. Like, this is your day. And growing up, you know, when I would watch these documentaries about how people feel about being adopted, not, you know, belonging, I had the opposite experience. I felt like I was meant to be part of my family. My sister and I feel like we were the wanted children. We, you know, it's like a very different feeling when you kind of, you know, put it that way. And my parents have always said, you know, they have all the information on our birth parents. You know, if we ever wanted to kind of find out any more information, they're registered in a program, because it was a state adoption. that we could always find out that information. And so because it was always available to us and spoken about very openly and honestly, you know, we felt so loved and a part of our unit.
Yeah.
But still to this day, at 47 years old, I don't think like, oh, I wonder what my, it's kind of weird to even say the word birth mother, because I just never think, like, my mother's my mother. I only know my parents. So I think if someone gets into this kind of psychological loop of, oh, but there was someone else, that's a psychological thing that you're kind of talking yourself into. Your parents are your parents, and I only know my parents. So it's like, I feel very fulfilled with that. And I think the best thing you can do is love a child, be open and honest with that child. And if you make it a non-issue, the same way we look at a lot of these children today that are being taught about equality and tolerance, you know, there are these great households out there that are doing that. These kids don't see race. They don't see sexual orientation. They're just like, that's another kid. So it's the same thing around adoption. It's like being very open and direct with it. That's what I feel.
100%. But I'm such a crazy Scorpio and I'm a control freak anyway, that I don't care if my kid looks like Annie. I don't care if that hair is red and that skin is milky white. Y'all better say he came from my stomach. I don't care. I dare somebody in my family to be like, well, you've been coming here for 18 years and you don't look like us. I'll be like, shut the f- up. DeAndre is my baby. But you know, you're right. You're right. You're totally right. And I should get that fear out of my head. I think I just, you know, I saw, speaking of Halle Berry, when I was a kid, I saw this movie called Losing Isaiah. Have you ever seen this movie?
Of course.
And I think it kind of scarred me for life.
I love how you say when you were a kid, you just made me feel old. But anyway, go ahead. Keep going. Keep going with yourself.
You know, we ageless. You know, us Black girls are ageless. I'm going to have to come back to something. I saw that movie, and for some reason, I don't know why, every time I go to the adoption process in my mind and in my heart, that movie always comes up, because I just have a hard time letting go of people. I have abandonment issues on my own. Mm-hmm. So just to think about losing that child, or that child thinking about going back to their birth parents, would freak me out a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's, but you know what, to be really honest with you, with a lot of these films, and even the way it's been portrayed in a lot of talk shows, you know, back in the early 2000s, et cetera, to me, it seems really unrealistic. I think it's a common trope, again, like the entertainment industry, they love their narratives to spin.
Yeah.
You know, like, all Black stories, it's got to be something struggling in the South, or slavery, or this, or in the hood. It's these, they just recycle the same stories. And it's the same thing around adoption. It's this whole idea of something's missing, got to find the birth parent, and blah, 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 blah. And I know plenty of other adopted, you know, adults who are like, I'm good. I'm really good.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, think about it. Let's say if I were to, like, I guess now meet my birth parents.
Yeah.
I mean, what do we do now? Do we check in on holidays? Do we what is that? It's a forced construct. Whereas my family is my family, and even my chosen family of my good friends and et cetera.
Yes.
That's my family.
100%.
Let's be real. I think at the end of the day, I think if it's something that you really want to do, and I mean, and you want to adopt versus kind of work using a surrogate, I'd say kind of let go of your fear. Cause remember, fear is only the anticipation of future pain. It's you're taking yourself out of the present moment, and you'll find the way to kind of, you'll bond with your child, and you'll find the way to have that communication and that open and honest communication. And that's what solidifies relationships, not bloodline, really.
Do you want children?
I did a long time ago. I really did. And I felt it was something, I love kids, and so many of my friends have kids. But, you know, then my career took off. And even before I was on TV, you know, on a Monday, I wouldn't know where I was gonna be on Wednesday. I would be in Europe, I'd be in Tokyo, I'd be where. I literally had this crazy life of constantly living on a plane. And then when I was on television, I was always on a set or flying to another destination or somewhere else. And now I'm 47 and I am not trying to raise a child. I have two dogs. I am good. I am not. My friends come over with their kids. We play. I am the great uncle. I am a godfather to kids. That's great. I love that. But oh, no, no, no. I'm not trying to raise a child through to college. Nope. Not at this point in my life.
Not today. Not today. Not now. Not on this Kelly Wurzel couch. You are not about to sit that diaper on there.
Exactly.
The wig, the bitch, and the meltdown is out today, you guys. You have to go pick it up. Where can people order this book from?
You can order this book everywhere books are sold. So you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, so e-editions, paperback, your bookstores, everywhere. And, the best place to kind of find all the links, you just go to jmanuel.com, and I've got them all up there.
I cannot wait to dive into this book. This was an unbelievable sip. I thank you because I feel like part of where I am in my life is because I got to see you loud and proud and killing it, you know, through all of these cycles and on E and just doing your thing, man.
It means a lot. It means a lot that you say that. I never really thought about it at the time, but hearing that now, it really does, you know, mean a lot. And I will tell you this genuinely and honestly, you know, when you first popped up on E, here's what I saw. I just saw such energy and a breath of fresh air that I love it because you come through the camera. So I think you're already on that road of figuring out what you need to do yourself. And again, this whole idea of going on this journey, you know, it's going to dictate what your next move is, but you already have the tenacity and the energy and just this, you translate a kind of a vulnerability and an honesty. And that's what I see. So, and I'm sure that's what everybody loves. So just keep being you. That's the best thing you can do.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Justin. It was so great talking to you. Like, lots of fun.
How fun was that?
So good and so much tea.
Let me just let you know something. Because J. Manuel, for me, was kind of sort of the person who I knew I was gay and I didn't want to say it yet, but I felt a sense of belonging knowing that outside of my small town in Louisiana that people celebrated gay men. And not only celebrated gay men, they listened to gay men and they saw their expertise and they were valued enough to put on television, which was crazy back in the cut. You know what I mean? I didn't even know that what a creative director was.
Right. I don't think a lot of us did across the world.
No. I had absolutely no idea that people would pay you to be a creative, because I thought if you were the photographer, you came up with the creative, or if you were the producer, you came up with the creative. And, you know, just to know that there are a lot of people out there who not only gay, not just straight, not just women, a lot of people took his advice, because a lot of what Jay was telling the contestants was to be yourself and go there and push yourself and believe in yourself. And when you think you can't do it, I bet you can get that shot. You can get that photo. And this was overwhelming emotionally for me just to have that person come in and have that conversation. And it just felt like it was the things that I needed to ask him my whole life because I had been watching him.
It felt like you guys had known each other your whole lives. Like you guys had an instant connection. And I think, like you said, what an important role. Like at that time for you, where there are a lot of, there weren't a lot of other gay men out on television like that, right?
No. Yeah. Reality TV, when America's Next Top Model was coming through, the only reality TV I had really saw before that was The Real World.
Right.
And The Real World, the gay men on The Real World were often put in the house because there was someone in the house who was a bigot.
Right.
And are homophobic.
Right.
And they always wanted to see what would happen to the roommates, you know, once this gay person came out and on television and let them know. And it was always so interesting because in reality TV, the gay man always felt like he was brought in to be the trigger. Not the example, and not
it was
the
like a story point, right? It wasn't like to me a good example.
And it was a story point in order to almost support somebody else's. It's really hard to explain because for most, you know, white men and women, cis, straight white men and women, you guys always got to see yourselves on TV. In the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, you know, if you were my age, you grew up with Wonder Years and you got to see, you know, Kevin, whatever, and then Home Improvement. You got to see your families again.
Right.
for myself as a gay man, I didn't really get to see someone every week. I got to see a guest star come in and talk about having HIV or coming out and his family disowning him or coming out as a drag queen. Like, that was what I saw sporadically of gay men on TV.
Right.
So to finally get to see someone in a real genre, you know, be themselves and talk about their career, it was like, oh, I could do more than just be a hairstylist or makeup artist and stop there. I can go to the next level. Not that anything's wrong with hairstylists, but
right.
That, you know, that was what you did when you were gay in Louisiana. You were a hairstylist. Right.
You were a hairstylist. And what's interesting, which is I don't know that a lot of people do acknowledge that. And it was a kind of an interesting point that he made at the beginning when he was like, this show was on the UPN. It was hosted by a Black woman. It had, you know, several Black leads as like the judges. And I don't ever know that it was recognized or celebrated for that.
Oh,
I think just kind of didn't pay attention to that. They passed it by. And I think that that's interesting that he said that, because when you think about it, you're like, wait a minute, it was groundbreaking on a lot of different levels.
How about that Top Model T though?
Yeah.
Bitch. Like my inside. Yeah,
me too.
And this is what I love about this show. I love this show because what happens on this show, and I'm gonna speak for broadly media. What happens in media is everybody has a blurb. You know, you could say, you know, if he would have told that story to a magazine or even on Daily Pop, we would have taken, you know, 2 minutes of that story. We wouldn't have been able to tell the full 100% 360 of this story. And what I love about this show is celebrities come here and they feel comfortable enough that we are not going to chop up their answers. We're not going to use them for clickbait. And in all honesty, that's what we set out to do with Just the Sip. We wanted people to feel like they were having a kiki.
Right, which is exactly what he said.
And that's what we want. And yeah, to hear that from him, to feel that from him, that he felt comfortable enough to talk about these things, knowing that we would never do him dirty in that sense of editing. Because when you're a creative director like that, or you're a TV personality, you know what right. The media will do.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So for sure.
I'm proud of my team, and I'm proud of E, and I'm proud of myself, and I'm proud of everybody who works on the show, that people feel like they can come and tell the full story.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting what he said about the pressure of people judging. Well, you went back for all the way up to cycle 19, right? And people don't know how hard these contracts are, how ironclad they are, and how you do get backed into a corner where you could essentially ruin your entire career.
100%.
And people might be like, oh, well, you should have more morals than that and you should walk away. But people don't walk away from everyday jobs sometimes when they should. And you can't judge anyone for wanting to keep their career and keep a roof over the head and keep food on their table when you're not in that position.
Amen. You guys, follow Jay. Get this book. You can get it anywhere it's sold. I'm sure it's a hit. After what he told me, I just ordered 2 copies as we were talking. And you guys, don't forget to follow me at The Lady Sitter. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, share this podcast with anybody who loved America's Next Top Model. And go on Apple and let me know what you think about this. I do read the reviews all the time. I wish I could like them and share them. I love them. So you guys go ahead and do that. And I will see you next week for another Just a Sip.